The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to today's edition of the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, as we answer your questions that have come in mostly by email, sometimes by phone call, and I guess we haven't gotten one from via telegraph in the past, but we won't rule that one out. You could always use snail mail, too. But my name is Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Saulnier as well.
Is that your attempt at 2019 humor?
It is. I thought I'd throw that extra little tidbit in there.
Trying to do a stand-up routine like David Letterman? Not David Letterman. He's gone. I don't know who does it anymore. Who's that guy? Jimmy Kimmel. No, not him.
Yeah, he does some.
He does one, but I'm thinking of the guy from NBC, the funny one. I don't find Kimmel that funny.
Jimmy Fallon. No, I'm not trying to be Jimmy Fallon.
Well, you're throwing humor in the middle of a serious show.
Well, the intro says it's a fun and enjoyable show. So
true,
I was trying to start it off kind of
fun.
I didn't realize I'd be ridiculed for the attempt. So today we're going to try to make a dent in this pile of email questions we've got.
Massive pile.
If you've ever liked to chat with us live online, the best way to do that would be to reach out to us ahead of time just to confirm when we're going to record. And make sure we've got all our ducks in a row before we are live on air with you. But if you've got something that's better addressed in kind of a back-and-forth conversation rather than an email, feel free to call us. You can set that up by going to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. You'll find a variety of ways to contact us right there on that webpage. And Laura, our fabulous assistant downstairs, would be happy to set something up with you. But today I think we're going to head mostly to the pile of email questions we've got. And as usual, it's a cornucopia of different topics. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the wrong season now. We're into January, but
it's a frozen snowball full of questions?
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway.
Although certainly not
a frozen snowball. We have a bunch of different kind
here.
Of questions.
It's going to be 60 degrees in a couple of days here.
That's
crazy.
Excellent. After it was 2 degrees last night. It's
yeah.
Chilly.
Oh, horror. We finally had a cold winter day here in Colorado. Go figure. It has been a hot, dry winter, fall. And winter is shaping up to be rather warm, which means I complain because it means the summer is going to be hot and dry, no rain, and it's going to decimate my garden again. And it just bugs the hell out of me. I can't get lettuce to grow.
Thank goodness for irrigation. Oh, it gets a little hot for lettuce.
It's too hot for the lettuce.
You need a cool house for lettuce.
Do they have those?
Yeah. One end of it, you can be like a swamp cooler. has like a wall that water drips on and fan blows through it, and it keeps it cool. Instead of keeping it warm in a greenhouse like you would in the
cool.
It'll actually keep it cool enough for.
And that'll probably
leafy
cost me
greens.
More in water and electricity than just going to the grocery store.
It'll be the most expensive lettuce you've ever eaten. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like owning your own chickens.
I think I'll skip that until I move to Kentucky.
Okay. Sounds good.
And then hopefully lettuce will grow in Kentucky in the summer because it certainly doesn't grow in Colorado. Okay, before we get to our massive stack of emails that poured in over the 2 weeks, and welcome back, everyone, listeners. We took time off for the holidays. Chris had his six kids that he had to run around with and do family things with, and yours truly had a plant to take care of at home, so that kept me busy over the holidays. And did have some people over, did have 12 people over, and cooked some elk green chili and elk roast for Christmas meal, and they seemed to like it. So overall, my holiday was fun. Hopefully all our listeners had a wonderful holiday season. And here we are going to be jumping into 2019. I guess hitting the ground running, so they say. But I want to do a little bit of housekeeping, Chris, on this Q&A show before we jump into the emails, because we have a lot of emails. Hopefully we can get through not only today, but over the next few weeks. But I want some house cleaning on probably the one show we did that elicited more comments, interest, confusion that we did last year. It was, I think, a November 21st show. I think it was the 21st. That mm-hmm. number sticks in my head. The show on Roth 60-day rollover conversions.
Yeah. Very popular topic, apparently.
It was, and it's caused a lot of angst amongst listeners and confusion, mostly for the listeners who have financial advisors who had no idea you could do it this way, and listeners who were being told by their advisors, you can't do what this guy's talking about. It won't work. So I want to make mention of this one more time, and then we will definitely jump into it probably next November or this coming November in another 11 months when we talk about this again. But the reason I want to make mention of it is one of the examples we gave or for instance, that we mentioned in the recording, I don't think is quite right, and we're going to want to change that November recording or at least play a little
Well, let me give them a quick recap of what the topic was.
Oh, sure.
Where essentially it was a way to buy yourself some time on doing a Roth conversion to help you figure out your tax situation going into the new year, when the conversion has to take place by the end of the calendar year, but you don't know your full tax situation. In the old days, we could not worry about this because if we made a mistake, we could always recharacterize the conversion later on up till October 15th of the year following the conversion. So that bought us a whole bunch of time to fix things if the converted amount was wrong. That's no longer on the table. So we've discovered a way that you can extend the clock a little bit by taking advantage of a 60-day rollover as the method of doing the Roth conversion. Essentially, you start the conversion in December, but you've got 60 days from constructive receipt of that money if you do it as a rollover, meaning you ask them to send you the money in the form of a check rather than you having them direct transfer it over to the Roth IRA that you're converting into. So then you've got this 60-day period, which is going to push you into February, and by that time, hopefully you'll have a better understanding. And at that point, you can roll back into a regular traditional IRA any monies that you decided you don't want to convert because you have a better understanding of your tax situation, and that you truly want to convert to the Roth can go to the Roth destination, but it doesn't actually have to be deposited in there until sometime in February, late February,
within
if you do this,
days.
Right, within 60 days of constructive receipt. And so that's that technique to buy you some time past the December 31st deadline is what some advisors advised some of our listeners you couldn't do,
and that's what happened. I ended up receiving a phone call from a listener who shared with me that she was trying to do this strategy, and her advisor was adamant that I guess you could say we didn't know what we were talking about, because he told her the one thing that he was certain on, is that her money needed to be put into a Roth IRA by December 31st. There was no way it could be done in the amount of time that they were looking at. And we were essentially wrong. So she called up and voiced that to me. And I instantly started doubting myself. I do that constantly. And I start in my head thinking, all right, do I have something wrong? Is her advisor right? This isn't the way I've learned it. This isn't the way I've always known it. This isn't the way I read the law to be. But I had some hesitancy. So I told, I says, look, let me get a hold of the big man himself and find out what the Ed Slot Group is going to say again, because they're the ones who told me about this to begin with. So I got a hold of them that day right away, and they replied back to me the very following day. And I simply asked them to clarify a few things just to make sure I was correct. And I asked them again that and explained the situation. And I said that it is my understanding that the Roth conversion will happen when the money leaves the IRA, not when it gets put into the Roth IRA. Even if it gets put into the Roth IRA next year, 2019, which I know is this year, but remember I did this a few weeks, just not even a few weeks ago, about 10, 11 days ago. And the answer came back right away. Jim, you are completely correct. Mm-hmm. So then I giggled and felt, okay, I thought so. And then I wish I knew who the broker was so I could tell him that the one thing he is adamant he's right on, he's actually wrong on.
It's the one thing he's wrong.
Yeah. Well, he's probably wrong on a few things. But it is not, folks, when the money goes into the Roth IRA that the conversion happens. It is when the money leaves the traditional IRA. Now, this is all a moot point because by the time you listen to this, it's 2019. But I wanted to clear the air on that yet again. And I want to clear the air in case there are listeners who are listening who didn't do the strategy because they thought it just doesn't sound right. How can you take money out in December from your IRA and effectively complete a Roth conversion even if you don't put the money in until, I don't want you to wait 60 days exactly, but you put the money in 50, 55 days later. So you're into a totally different tax year and you don't put the money into the Roth IRA then. How can that be a conversion? And how?
It's just how they...
It's the way the law is.
Yeah, the law determined that the date of record is the date the money leaves the traditional IRA. Just to have a consistent, because otherwise you'd have people counting different days. They wanted to clarify it. They wanted to make one rule. This is how it works, period.
Now, one thing we were wrong on is when does the clock begin? Now, we were 100% correct on when the 60-day clock begins. The 60-day clock begins when you receive constructive receipt of the money. And we talked about examples, and these are examples that were backed up with private letter rulings, court cases. It is not when you call up the IRA and ask them to send the money out. It's not when the money is recorded as leaving your IRA, in the sense many IRAs, many brokerage accounts, Chris, when you call and request money, even though, and they're going to send you a check, even though you haven't cashed the check yet, they reduce the balance of your account by the amount of your withdrawal long before you cash the check. It's not like a bank where they're waiting for this check to come in. If you call up your brokerage house and say, hey, send me $100,000 from my $500,000 account, you all of a sudden are going to have $400,000 in it. Even though you haven't cashed the check yet, as soon as they issue that check and send it out, they debit the value of your account. Right. It's not when that happens. And it's not when you get the check put into your mailbox. It's when you actually touch and hold and receive the check. And we talked about examples of people who were, a gentleman was in jail. Well, there was one in jail, and there was another one who didn't go to jail. What happens when your family says he's crazy, put him in a house? Committed.
Well, he's been committed.
Mm-hmm. There was one guy who did a 60-day rollover. This was a court case. A private letter ruling. And in between requesting his money and getting his money, his family had him committed. And he couldn't get the check, even though it was there at his house. He didn't have it. And the IRS gave him relief as well. So it's when you physically touch and receive the check. So we said if you wanted to stretch out that time, if you wanted even more than technically 60 days to figure this all out, although most people could probably figure out within 60 days of the new year what their income for the year was and how much they should have converted, we said request a check and go on vacation or jokingly go get committed. And that would set the time for the 60-day period. So that was 100% correct. But we said the 365-day period, because remember, you can only do one rollover per year. And it's not calendar year. It's 365-day period. So we generally recommend in our practice on the 366th day, just to make sure, you can affect another 60-day rollover if you want. We said that clock, Chris, starts when the money leaves the IRA.
Right. So effectively, we said it started the same day the rollover is considered happening.
Correct. When the money leaves the IRA, not when you receive the check. Which, because the brokerage houses show that money leaving the IRA instantly, even though the check hasn't been cashed, it's essentially would be the day you call them, or at least the day they acted on. If you called them on a Friday and they didn't do it till the following Monday, that would be the day of the conversion. And we said that would be the day the 365-day clock begins. And that we were wrong on.
Right.
That one, as the EdSlot group clarified with me again, begins also on the day the constructive receipt is. So you never talk with Ed, you talk to his minions. So the consultant that I was chatting with, she said, in your example of what you're doing, you would have to do it every other year or at least skip a year, unless, and we did point this out on our podcast on the 21st, unless all the money goes into the Roth IRA, then that was not a 60-day rollover. Money that goes in and stays into a Roth is not a 60-day rollover, and you can do one the following year at any time. It's only if you direct any money that is in this outstanding rollover world, only if you direct some of that money back to your IRA because you figured out, wow, I took $10,000 out. I was going to convert $10,000. I should have only converted $8,000. I'm going to move $2,000 back to my IRA. Only if you did something like that and put money into back into a traditional IRA is there the one per 365-day rule.
Because that 365-day rule is used to prevent or discourage people from taking loans out of their IRAs, taking the money out, using it for 60 days, putting it back in. People were doing that repeatedly, so they put in this once per year rule because that wasn't what that 60-day rollover was intended to do. Now, if it's a legitimate conversion and you happen to do it via a rollover, meaning you get the money, you take it, and you put it all in, that's conversion, not rollover by itself, so it escapes that one per year thing because they expressly say you can do as many conversions as you want.
Absolutely. You can do as many 60-day rollover conversions as you want.
Yeah.
But it's only if money goes back into the traditional IRA is the one per 365-day rule applicable. And if it is, then you have to wait 366 days before you can do it again. However, all is not lost, folks. If you are a married couple, it's one per person. So 1 year, what Chris and I are trying to explain is, let's say you took the money out December 28th. You got right to the end of the year. You took money out of your traditional IRA. And that gives you 60 days. That's going to give you well into February, towards the end of February. to figure out exactly what you want to do. Now you put it all into a Roth IRA. You don't need to move any back to your IRA. Your tax calculation was accurate and you are happy with the amount you took out as a conversion. No problem. The following year, which is 2019, this year you could do another one. No problem. Mm-hmm. But let's say again, it comes February, you're starting to get your 1099s in, your bonuses are in, all these things are in. You're starting to look at your taxable income and realizing, whoa, this was more than I want to pay taxes on. Or the market keeps falling. And maybe you wanted to do the conversion tax-wise, but the assets, well, you took money out, so the asset, that's a bad example.
Yeah, but you would have sold. You might have sold things to create the cash.
You might have sold, and now you realize that those assets would have been worth a lot less, and you don't want to have converted them. You want them back in there. Only if you move money back to the IRA do you have to wait 1 year. But you have to wait 1 year from when you received constructive receipt, which isn't December 28th. Maybe it was January 5th. So that means you have to wait till the following January 6th, and in 2019, you wouldn't be able to use this strategy. But if you were married and you took the money from your IRA, you could always do one from your wife's IRA or your husband's IRA in 2019 at any time. Remember, it's one per year, one per 365 days per taxpayer, not per couple. So if you do this strategy, don't take a little out of your IRA and a little out of your spouse's IRA. You could use one IRA for 1 year and another IRA for the following year. That way, you're not going to have to skip a year. But if you are single, like I am, or you're a married couple, but only one of you has the IRA that you were trying to convert, and you did take money out in 2018, but you received constructive receipt in 2019, you would have to wait until, and you move money back to the IRA. You don't leave it all in the Roth. Remember, if it all stays in the Roth, folks, this whole point is moot. Because money going from an IRA to a Roth IRA is a 60-day rollover, does not have the one-per-year rule. It's only if you backdate, or not backdate, but push back money into the IRA. You took too much out. You want to put more in the IRA. Now you have to wait 365 days from the date you received constructive receipt of the money, which is also the same date the 60-day clock begins. Did I explain that okay?
Yeah, and let me clarify one thing, though. If you're doing 60-day rollovers, I regret doing it because my assets dropped in value, you're out of luck.
That's what I'm saying. You didn't convert an asset. You converted money.
Yeah, but you use that as a reason why you might want to put the money back. You can't.
It was a reason when we could recharacterize.
You moved
the assets.
Right, electronically.
The assets have lost.
Right.
But when you're taking money, that's why I said
so if it's a rollover, which is obviously cash coming out, because that's the only thing they're going to send you is cash in the form of a check. You've already sold the assets.
Right. It's already moved.
It's water under the bridge.
That's why I was saying it doesn't matter. But you were like, no, you could still move it back. And I was thinking, oh, okay. But it doesn't make, from a tax standpoint, it doesn't make any difference. Because you didn't move the asset, you moved money. You already sold the asset.
Correct.
And it dropped. So moving the money back to the IRA isn't going to help you.
Correct.
I agree.
Just wanted to make sure everybody was on the
same
page.
That's what I thought originally. I thought, that doesn't sound right. What's it matter? Because the money is out.
Money's out. Could put the money back. It's not going to help you with the asset drop.
No. But anyways, I wanted to clear the air on that because we gave the example of someone doing this around the holidays, going on vacation and not getting constructive receipt. I think we said until January 15th.
Right.
And then we said the 60-day clock would begin from there. Well, so does the one-year clock. And I think on the show we said the one-year clock will begin on the day the money
left. In December,
left.
And that was wrong.
And that is wrong.
Right.
So I'm glad that broker was wrong because it compelled that listener to contact us, which compelled me to contact the Ed Slot Group again to confirm everything. And the whole gist of everything that we had explained is correct, except for that time period. But as I thought about it, I figured, well, if it's a married couple in their each have IRAs, it's a moot point. One does it 1 year, next does it the next year, and you can do one per year, even if you're moving money back to the IRA. Or if you are a single person or only have one IRA, one part of the couple has the IRA, the husband or the wife, any money that, if no money gets moved back to a traditional IRA and it all stays in the Roth, again, moot point. Mm-hmm. One per year rule doesn't apply.
Perfect.
Okay, just wanted to clear the air on that. We're going to put a disclose, what do you call it?
We'll amend the previous broadcast.
Or whatever, yeah. On the, we're going to just let people know on that also. So nobody runs afoul of the one per year rollover rule. Okay. So where the heck are all the emails I was going to answer this week?
Here we go. Slew.
No, we got them. Wrong pile.
Okay.
Okay. This will lead in with a Social Security question.
Okay.
For a listener from, go figure,
Georgia.
Georgia. Again, I have no idea if people
we
are
need to open an office
us.
In Georgia, apparently.
Apparently. We have a lot of Georgians. He gave his real name, and then he said, you can call me George. George from Georgia. Okay. It's a very long email, as you can see. Let me just give a brief summary of it. Him and his wife are going to claim Social Security, but he has a son with severe autism who is fully disabled and collecting SSI benefits. Just want to set that straight, okay?
Probably SSDI.
Well, he put SSI.
Yeah, but it's could be. But if it's using the word disabled, usually that means Social Security disability. But okay. I don't know what – it doesn't say how old the son is,
nope.
So I don't know.
Nope. Okay. So he begins. My question is, how are delayed retirement credits in the family maximum will collide as it relates to survivor benefits? Because I am planning on having my son collect half of my primary insurance amount after I begin collecting retirement benefits. And he indicated he's going to collect his retirement benefits, Chris, at age 70. My wife will collect her own benefits on her own record. I know the delayed retirement credits will not apply to the family maximum, so no issue there. But I'm trying to understand what happens if my wife and son survive me if I predecease them. Will my wife collect the same amount as my retirement benefits, including the delayed retirement credits, but my son will receive 75% of that? Or will the total be reduced due to the family maximum, which is 175% of my PIA? This is a very confusing email that people won't be able to follow. But can you clear the air on him?
Let me clarify.
What happens?
Mm-hmm. So when you receive retirement, disability, or survivor benefits, there is such a thing as the family maximum, the most that a family can receive off of one worker's record. Now, the disability family maximum actually has its own calculation. We're not talking about that here. We're talking about his question, which is ultimately survivor benefits. Now, while he's still alive, if he is collecting, his spouse may be collecting a spousal, he has a child maybe collecting, we've got several people collecting on the same record, the family maximum is going to apply to those retirement benefits. And those retirement benefit family maximums are between 150 and 185, roughly, percent of the PIA. Now, he states that his family maximum is 175%. So the good news is delayed retirement credits, if they exist, are not considered part of the family maximum calculation. All they're looking for is, first of all, the family maximum doesn't go up because of the delayed retirement credits. The family maximum is based on your PIA. And because of that, they only count against it the PIA amount, not the additional credits you're getting from delaying claiming like he plans to do by delaying till 70. This is true of both retirement and survivor benefits. So if his family maximum is indeed 175%, then if he passes away, his wife can receive his benefit and his son can receive the dependent benefit. And between the two of them, they should be getting 175% plus the wife getting the benefit of those delayed retirement credits that he created by waiting to 70 to claim. So I believe for this particular instance, if I have all the facts of the case, he shouldn't be affected. Now, I'm just going by what he said, that his family maximum was 175%. There's a formula based on a person's PIA that will determine the family maximum. I don't have that information for him, so I can't confirm whether or not the 175 is accurate. But the bottom line good news, I guess, is that delayed retirement credits are not lumped in to the family maximum calculation. So you don't have to worry about being penalized, if you will, from waiting. Because if they took them away from you because of the family maximum, there'd be an incentive for some people not to delay, because there would be no benefit. They'd scrape it back via the family maximum cap. For that reason, they don't do that. The delayed retirement credits, if you earn them, you get them. That does not, that will not be the reason why your family maximum hits and your benefits are reduced. So do I give enough good news for your coughing fit to subside?
Oh,
some of you
God.
May have heard in the back.
Could they hear my lung?
I don't think so, but I was contemplating having to step around and give you the Heimlich.
I took a big sip of coffee.
Yeah.
And I think 90% of it ended up in my lungs.
Oh.
Oh, my Lord.
You had a 50-50 shot and you missed. But yet you're still drinking it. I was worried that you picked up maybe a coffee that you had left up here several weeks.
No.
Because I would have had the similar reaction.
No, I'm trying to drink it now because my throat is all sore. If anybody could hear me coughing up a lung, I apologize. That's what happens when we, first of all, do no takes on this.
I think you were far enough away that they didn't.
And
really
I shut the
much.
Mic off.
You shut yours off, and I think mine's far enough away that.
So, good Lord. Okay, thank you for answering that question for that listener. Okay, that's another Social Security question we'll hold off. Let's do a non-Social Security question. Okay, this one has to do with Irma. I believe we answered a question similar to this. This is for an Illinois resident, an Illinoisan. Is that what they were called?
Sure.
Do you figure Part B premiums and then add in your modified adjusted gross income to get the total that you owe? Now, the way he asked that confused the hell out of me until I read his example.
Okay.
For example, the chart says a married couple filing jointly with income between $214,000 and $267,000 pays a surcharge of $133.90 on their Medicare premiums. Do I still have to add the $135.50 Medicare Part B premium to the $133.90, making it $268.40 as what I would owe?
Bingo.
Yeah. Ding, 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 ding.
That's exactly what you do.
Yeah, because if not, your premiums are going down.
Yeah, you're down. You're saving a couple bucks, right?
The more you make, the less you pay. Yeah. IRMA, for those who don't know, folks, stands for Income-Related Monthly Adjusted Amount. Right now, it's not much of a big deal. And Chris and I talk about it a lot because we know the insidiousness of this IRMA rule. Because when they passed IRMA, and they passed it under the Obama administration, and we are certainly not playing politics here and picking on Obama. We point out that the Reagan administration was the first to tax Social Security. The Clinton administration was the next administration to tax Social Security. And the Obama administration is the first administration to essentially means test Medicare premiums. But they won't be the last administration to play around with Medicare premiums. So what they do under IRMA rules, income-related monthly adjusted amount, is if your income is above certain levels, you will pay surcharges on your Medicare premiums. The income levels, though, Chris, are so high, hardly anyone's paying attention to it.
Right. Because for a married filing joint couple, it's $140,000.
$170,000.
$170,000.
Yes, I was going to say, trust me.
I knew 70
that.
Was in there. Yeah. So it's 170. Mm-hmm. A single person's half that, $85,000.
Before they start paying
the
surcharges.
Before they start paying even the smallest surcharge. So not a lot of people, and this is the explanation, that this is the excuse they used for taxing Social Security. Oh, hardly anyone is going to end up paying taxes on their Social Security because these limits are so high. Well, they're not so high anymore.
And that's the point I was trying to make. When they passed the Social Security taxation laws, nobody paid attention to it then either, because you were not taxed unless you had modified adjusted gross income in excess of a whopping $25,000. And in 1981, when the, it was 81 or 83, when the law, I think it was 83, when the law was passed, not many retirees made more than that. Mm-hmm. And they said less than 1% of retirees were going to pay taxes on their Social Security. What they didn't tell you, but was there if you read the law, is they're not going to index any of that for inflation. Today, it's still $25,000.
For a single person. Mm-hmm.
For a single person as the initial measure, $35,000 for a married couple. And who doesn't hit that practically in retirement? So it's sucking in more and more people into right. taxation of Social
now,
Security.
Now, Irma, in defense of Irma, it is set up ultimately to be adjusted for inflation. However, right now it's frozen for the next 10 years. It's frozen through 2028.
It's not frozen. That's incorrect. It's supposed to be adjusted for inflation beginning in 2019. We'll find out in November. It is the new $500,000 or more of income bracket's been frozen for 10 years.
Oh, only that bracket?
Only that
bracket. Oh, I knew the 2028 was in my...
So that bracket's been frozen for 10 years, but...
See, I only had half the Irma story then.
You did. But this law was passed 10 years ago. And initially, the brackets were supposed to increase for inflation, and every year they've kept delaying it. So for 10 years, they've never increased a bracket for inflation. And Obama, President Obama, made it clear he didn't want to start increasing the brackets for inflation until 25% of Medicare recipients were paying the surcharge. And it's not going to be 25% of low-income Medicare recipients. It's going to be 25%. It's probably be 100% of everyone listening to this show. Because if you're listening to this show, you probably are a do-it-yourselfer with assets, and that's who they're going for. So let's just make that perfectly clear. So that's why Irma can be, in my feelings, something very insidious, not now, but 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years from now, when you are 80, 85 years old and can least understand what's going on, and your Medicare premiums are being subject to surcharges. And these are the surcharge levels today. Of course, they're going to go higher and higher and higher. Yep. But this listener's question is, do you have to take the surcharge amount and add in the Medicare Part B premium? Yes. The surcharge amount isn't your new Medicare premium. It's on top of your Medicare premium. Yep. And one thing he doesn't mention, it also includes a Part D drug plan surcharge as well. Mm-hmm. So you have to factor that in as well. They figure it out a little differently. If you read the law, you'll understand how it happens. Now, I agree people with this much income, the amount of surcharge is minimal. It's like 1% or 2% of their total income as a surcharge. But if they would have turned around and started a special Medicare tax of 2% of your income, if your income is above a certain level, people would be up in arms over that. So they just pass it as this little surcharge, bury it, and make it hard to follow and make the math difficult, and they can get away with it. So keep it in mind, folks. Irma is going to be a big issue for most people. And listener from Illinois, the numbers you're looking at are not your new Medicare premiums. That made me giggle when I read this. I'm like, no, your premiums don't go down. That is the surcharge in addition to your premium. And one other thing I want to point out, the widower tax penalty part on this. We cannot end this discussion without pointing out, even though Chris was correct, well, actually he was wrong until I corrected him. It's $170,000, but he is correct. There was a seven in there. It is $170,000 for a married couple before they are hit with their first Medicare premium surcharge. That number is cut in half at the death of the first spouse. So at the death of the first spouse, it's only $85,500. And depending on how that income is being generated, Chris, especially if it's coming from RMDs and the husband and wife are similar in age, they're going to hit the premium surcharge level instantly at the death of the first spouse. So the survivor gets less Social Security because the smaller the two Social Securities go away. The tax brackets are compressed. Right now, under the Trump tax cuts, the married brackets are exactly double the size of the single brackets, which means when the first spouse dies, boom, 50% cut in the size of those brackets, meaning more of your income is being forced through more brackets, so the government's sucking more taxes out of you, and boom, you're also going to be hit with Medicare premium surcharges. Now you understand why we call this the widower tax penalty. And if that tax penalty is being driven by required minimum distributions and you're not factoring in survivorship into your decision-making, especially when it comes to Roth conversions, because conversions are one of the prime ways to fight Irma and widower tax penalty issues, because Roth distributions are not counted under Irma calculations, they will not cause Social Security to be taxed, they do not fall victim or have required minimum distribution rules associated with them, you have to be factoring in all of this to any Roth conversion decision. And all too often, Chris, most listeners, and not longtime listeners to this podcast, because they've heard us talk about this over and over again, but a lot of people who are new podcastians or a lot of people who may be working with advisors who don't look at the full picture, and they're being told, oh, you don't want to convert. You're in such a high bracket right now. That's silly. Just wait till required minimum distributions begin. And that's why we call the period of time between retirement and required minimum distributions your tax planning window. I used to call it your tax hole, because when you hire us to do a tax projection and we show it to you, it kind of looks like a hole in the middle of your brackets. That's how I came up with it. No one liked it too much. Justin, before he left, called it the tax void, which I just never cared for either. And you hit the nail on the head.
I think so.
You did. You did great. Tax window, he calls it, listeners. Why? Because it's temporarily open.
Right.
And it doesn't close right away, although sometimes it does, but sometimes it closes gradually. So we call that the tax planning window. But remember, Roth conversion analysis goes well beyond what bracket you're in today.
Way beyond. So much you hear, and this is, look at other internet sources with, they're always talking about one thing. What's my tax rate today? What's it going to be in retirement? That's it. That's all they talk about.
It's asinine.
That's the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly.
That is pertinent to the discussion.
Absolutely.
That is something to be considered. But it's like reading the first chapter of a book and trying to, think of you got the whole story. It's not even close. Not even close.
Yep.
So.
Okay. Okay. This one is probably going to be one we can answer a little bit quickly. And this is from a Virginian. Fine state of Virginia. Right next to?
West Virginia.
Which is also next to?
Tennessee.
Say it for Pete's sakes. No.
Kentucky.
Thank you.
Okay,
and
I
did
guess.
You know on the Kentucky-Virginia border?
Yeah.
There are elk.
What kind of elk?
Elk.
like actual elk?
Elk.
I didn't think elk existed east of the Mississippi and south of the Canadian border.
They're in Pennsylvania. There's an elk season in Pennsylvania, and there is an elk season.
I didn't realize that.
There's an elk season in Kentucky.
Just deer back there.
Now, I highly doubt Kentucky elk season is going to be nearly as good as Colorado elk season, but I was looking at the Kentucky hunting laws.
I bet
laws.
Our elk are bigger and better.
I was looking at the Kentucky gun laws and hunting laws, and I was surprised to see elk season. So I started researching, and it's right along the Kentucky-Virginia border is elk.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
I wonder why they just stand right there on the line. That's weird.
No, I'm sure they cross. They don't.
Oh, I thought they were just lined up there. waiting to cross. Yeah.
waiting for me to go shoot one. But anyway, so if I do relocate to the fine state of Kentucky, which would be next to Virginia, I could also elk hunt. Okay. So this begins with a guy we will protect his anonymity, and we're going to name him George, as we always do, and he's from Virginia. Mm-hmm. And he writes, regarding cash value life insurance policies, is there anything better than naming your spouse as the primary beneficiary and your children as contingent beneficiaries? I have been listening to another podcaster who said it was better to name your trust for asset protection purposes. And he wants to know our thoughts. And my initial thoughts are, yes, that other podcast person is correct. I love, L-O-V-E, love, trusts as beneficiaries of life insurance policies. Mm-hmm. I don't love trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs, 401ks, and things of that nature. That's a hideous nightmare waiting to happen. But I do like trusts as beneficiaries of life insurance policies if the trust is created correctly and the main aim of the trust is what you are trying to achieve. Trusts should be created for protection and control. There will be no tax benefits to naming the trust. It's protection and control. If you have a life insurance policy paying out several hundred thousand or several million, we have many clients with millions of dollars of life insurance, and they name as beneficiary of their life insurance policy a trust. And then the trust will receive this money tax-free, at least under current laws. The money from the life insurance policy is paid out tax-free to the trust, and the trust will grant, which could be millions of dollars, Chris, full protection from the beneficiary's creditors, predators, and bankruptcy. And predators are also ex-spouses who may want to get their hands on your money merely because they were married to your child but now are going through a divorce. So a trust for protection and control is wonderful. There's no tax benefits to the trust. Except for estate tax issues, I will agree if the trust was set up correctly in what is known as an irrevocable life insurance trust. But with estate tax exemptions being as high as they are, that's a moot point nowadays as well.
For almost everybody.
For all but 0.7% of the population, literally. Mm-hmm. So a trust should be set up for protection and control. If you are looking to protect that asset, for your beneficiaries, especially because life insurance policies could be millions of dollars. Even hundreds of thousands of dollars is a lot. But it could be millions. A trust will still allow the money to go to the beneficiaries, but give it protection and control. So he says, is there anything better than naming the spouse outright as primary and the children outright as contingent? No, the trust is okay. I don't have a problem with that. The question becomes, though, if you have a life insurance policy that pays out at the death of either spouse, not both at the same time, that's called a second to die, you still may want to name, Chris, the first spouse as primary and the contingent as the trust. Or create a trust that will allow the money to go into it for the benefit of the primary beneficiary, which would be the spouse, And then at the spouse's death, it can go benefit the children. So you can do it either way. You may want to run through with your estate planning attorney which one fits your spouse's needs better. And if it's a blended family situation, you may want to use a trust always so your life insurance policies or proceeds could benefit your current spouse, but at that spouse's death will ultimately go to your children. Whereas if you left them outright to your spouse, that spouse could get remarried or leave them to their children.
The remarriage issue. Too. Even if the spouse doesn't willingly hand over money to their new spouse that you may want to prevent, it could get messed up in a bad relationship and they have claim on those depending on where those assets are held if it was paid directly to the spouse, the surviving spouse. So there might be all kinds of reasons why you'd even put it in a trust when you still have a spouse surviving you. Absolutely. But again, everybody's circumstances are different. That's the key. You need a good estate planning attorney to understand your situation and recommend what's appropriate for you. So we're just kind of talking generalities here.
These are all generalities, mm-hmm. but I will agree with that other podcaster you spoke mm-hmm. about. I'm a little hesitant to say it's the only thing or the best thing. It is a good thing, but everyone is different, and you have to look at the entire situation. And you also have to weigh the size of the life insurance and the cost of hiring an attorney to create a trust. You're looking at several thousand dollars probably to create this trust. And then if things change in the future and you want to change the trust, you may need to involve an attorney on that as well. And it can get a little bit more expensive. And then, of course, there's going to be trust administration issues. You're going to have a trustee, trust tax returns, not right away when you set up the trust, at death when it gets funded. So your beneficiaries right. will have expenses that wouldn't be imposed upon them if you just left them the money. But if you have children who are spendthrifts, children who might be in a highly litigious career, such as a surgeon or any other type of physician who can get sued a lot, or a police officer like I was. We were always worried about being sued. So you have to kind of look at each situation. But I do like trusts as beneficiaries of life insurance policies if the trust is created properly. Yeah. Okay. Here is a listener named Georgette. Mm-hmm. From
this is the final question, by the way.
Oh, it is? We're not going to get to the other five?
No.
Okay, you realize we still have 23 plus this five, so we're up to 28.
I know. We can't answer them all in one day, though.
All right. This one is a Californian named Georgette. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your show. Her question is, assume I inherit either a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA that I elect stretch payments. If I die with money in the inherited IRA, can my beneficiary restretch the IRA, or do they have to continue withdrawing at the rate that I was using?
That's an excellent question.
Do you want to answer it or do you want me to?
There's no restretch. Do you want to expand on that? Because otherwise, you could kind of, it'd be ping pong down, and it defeats the purpose of the
before you go
forcing.
There, though,
yeah, go ahead.
Why don't you explain to new listeners and those who are still hungover from New Year's what a stretch IRA is?
So a stretch, which is currently available but susceptible to being discarded by Congress if they decide to eliminate the stretch provision, allows a non-spouse beneficiary. So a spousal beneficiary has a unique right, which is they can just roll an inherited IRA into their own, and they don't have to worry about taking RMDs aside from their normal RMD schedule that would be applying to their own IRA. So we're talking about non-spouse beneficiaries here. So a non-spouse beneficiary has to begin taking money out. They can't just leave it in there. And this was everyone's intent with these retirement plans. They didn't want these to kind of grow and grow and grow and become legacy wealth transfers to generation after generation after generation. So it was meant for your own retirement. Then the next beneficiary traditionally would have had to take all the money out within 5 years. When they enacted the stretch provision, is what it's, that's the slang term, but the stretch provision, that allowed non-spouse beneficiaries to then stretch out the RMDs over their life expectancy. This is assuming that the person that died hadn't begun starting taking RMDs in the first place. That's where the rules are cleanest, is you've got someone who died, they hadn't taken the money out, they weren't over the age of 70 and a half, or technically they hadn't reached their required beginning date, and you inherit it. You can then elect to take the money out, take it out within 5 years, or start RMDs in the year following the year of death of the owner, and following the RMD schedule for non-spouse beneficiaries. When you die, if there's still money in there, no more stretching it or re-stretching it, which is, you know, you could name a beneficiary that was super young and then let them stretch it out then over another 70 years or something like that. That's not allowed. That's not allowed. The IRA has to continue on the old path, correct, Jim? You have a couple choices. When the first beneficiary dies and say they want to hand it off to their beneficiaries, the RMD schedule from the non-spouse beneficiary who inherited the IRA, that can continue for the next generation, correct? Or do you have to take it out within 5 years?
No. Excuse me. I confess I wasn't paying attention to a thing you were saying.
Oh. Well, I was right up until I stopped right here because I can't remember for sure all the options of the second upon the second death.
Are you trying to bring me up to date? So someone passes away in this example.
Yep.
This person inherits the IRA.
Yep. Starts RMDs on their life
expectancy.
So
you've already explained what a stretch is to our listeners.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the listeners know all about stretch. And let's just say that this person could stretch for 26 years. I'm just picking that out.
Yeah.
And they die in year 16.
Right.
So there are 10 years remaining.
Yep.
The beneficiaries will step in. They are not called contingent beneficiaries. They are called successor beneficiaries.
Right.
And they simply step in and begin with the same divisor, reducing by one, all the way down.
So that I was right, that is one option. They can continue, but they don't get to re-stretch, which is what they were talking about.
No.
Setting it up under their life expectancy. That only happens that one time.
What one time?
When the first death happened in the inheritance, that RMD schedule that was created for the first beneficiary, that's as far as it'll stretch. It'll never stretch beyond that.
There's only one obscure exemption to that. I'd be more than happy to share it, or we can do it on another one. But it is an obscure obsession that would make you look brilliant in Trivial Pursuit if it was ever a question. Mm.
See, this is what I don't pick up because I don't go to the Ed Slot.
You don't go to the Ed Slot meetings. But no, so to answer the listener's question, there is no restretch. I know, Chris, and I apologize to my listeners. We're busy in the office, and I was actually reading some client cases. But I heard my name, and I think you saw me look up. I was like, excuse me?
Well, I thought you were listening and looking at something.
No, I have my headphones on, but I totally zonked out what you were saying.
No, I was just confirming that they could continue on the same time clock because I hadn't thought about this for a while. It's not that often that someone dies owning an inherited IRA, that they die before they've taken all the money out. Most people take it out a lot faster than the minimum speed that they go out. So I hadn't thought about it for a while, but yes, it's coming clearer to me even before you confirmed my suspicions.
But they are called successor beneficiaries.
Correct.
The one exemption to this, very obscure exemption, exemption to this is involving a spouse. So remember, we said once on a show, which we have to record because we were told by a very, very smart gentleman that the show we did on what happens to an IRA when a spouse inherits it was so confusing, he couldn't even follow it. And this man was smart. I talked to him on the phone for over an hour. And I even said that. I said, if you're not following it, most people aren't following it. But anyways, the one obscure example of where someone could theoretically restretch is when a spouse inherits an IRA, Remember, spouse has many choices. And one choice is the spouse can stay as beneficiary, keep it as a inherited IRA, but they have no required minimum distribution rule, Chris, until the deceased spouse turns 70 and a half.
Would have turned 70.
Would have turned 70 right. and a half. So if the deceased spouse passes away and they're 60, the spouse could, I'm just made that up. So the spouse steps in, let's say she's 60. So she steps in and for one reason or another, leaves it as a beneficiary IRA.
Instead of rolling it into her
own. Instead of moving it into her own. Now, if it was a non-spouse beneficiary, they would have to begin stretched IRA payments.
I see where you're going with this.
But a spouse does not have to. She can stay as a beneficiary of the account, leave it there, and not have to begin RMDs until 10 and a half years later when the spouse, deceased spouse, would have been 70 and a half. Okay, that said, what if she dies in between there?
Right, that's the time. Because it hasn't, technically it hasn't, this, there's still no restretch because it was never stretched in the first place.
Technically it wasn't stretched in the first place.
Right, it just was on the same, it was on the RMD schedule.
Someone
of the
who inherits
original owner.
An inherited IRA that way gets to stretch.
Got it.
So if that wife, let's just say the husband died, the wife inherits it at 60, and for some odd reason does not move it into her own IRA, stays as beneficiary of that IRA. Most likely it would be a mistake. She didn't know she could have. She just left it there.
Right.
There are no RMDs until her husband, the deceased gentleman, turned 70 and a half. So, again, in my example, it's 10 years after he dies. So, for the first 5 years, she just leaves it sitting there. Then she dies. As long as she named successor benefit, they would have been successor beneficiaries. As long as she named beneficiaries to inherit that account and step in, if she dies, as long as she named someone, those people would step in and be allowed to stretch. Because she hadn't began RMDs yet. But as soon as RMDs begin, that goes away.
Right.
And it is now subject to the distribution.
That is a pretty obscure exception.
You probably will never see it except in a rare case. And if you see it at all, it's most likely due to a mistake.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
That's all she wrote.
That's all I had. So I want to thank everybody for our first inaugural Q&A show. If anybody has their own Qs, we got the A's. We just don't know how quickly we can get to them sometimes. And what you can do is go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Click on the Contact Us button and you can send us a question. Or if you want to just do it direct, email your own questions to Jim at JimHelps.com. That's Jim at JimHelps.com, and we will get to your questions as soon as we possibly can. And of course, for everybody listening, all our podcastian listeners, whether you're an iTunian or an Androidian, it doesn't matter to us. For everyone throughout the United States who is listening to our show, we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners, just happen to be located in the state of Colorado, but we work with people throughout the United States. If you're looking for independent, unbiased advice on your retirement, retirement planning is all we do. It's not a bullet point on our website under list of services where we have dozens and dozens of services we allegedly offer. We specialize in distribution planning. We know the rules, we know the laws, we know the taxation. If you're looking for a second opinion or some advice and or help on your retirement, but you're not looking for someone who's going to force you to roll over all their assets with them and charge you 1.5%, 1.25% to manage your assets and do all this other funky stuff that a lot of people out there want to do, if you simply want people who are going to help you analyze your situation, look at your retirement and give you unbiased advice, you might want to consider at least talking to us for our coffee and a second opinion where we can together make a determination if we feel we can help you or not. If you're interested in that, you can also go to our website, JimHelps.com. jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. Click on the schedule meeting button in the upper left-hand corner, and you can schedule your own Coffee and a Second Opinion phone call.
Perfect. Thanks, everybody, for joining us this week. We'll be back next week to answer another batch of questions.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.